Thank you all really very much. It's like coming home to come to the Philadelphia Society, and especially when the subject is Latin America, and I see so many people here who first invited me to speak in Latin America. I spoke so often in Latin America in the 1970s and the 1980s that I was offered citizenship in at least three countries. Steve is quite right about the importance and influence of Latin America on the tradition of liberty, which is usually unknown to most people in North America. First, let me mention the influence of the Salamanca School of Spain, first on the ideas of lowering taxation in order to increase revenue and to increase supply, and a host of similar ideas. How did that happen? It happened because the Franciscans and other missionaries who accompanied the early colonists had to cope with an entirely new economic situation. They were no longer in nations in which most of the land was held by the great landowners and most of the people worked as serfs. They were now in a place where these wide open lands, and the question is, what do you do to encourage people to develop them? And they faced a circumstance in which, when the king's taxes were too high, production was lowered. And some people found it cheaper and easier to sell to the pirates, who charged less than the king did. And so they gradually worked out some of these ideas in a very powerful way, to which Adam Smith and Francis Hutcheson pay due respect, as does Frederick Hayek. But second, and even more important and more unknown, is the great case of the trial in Spain about the rights of Indians. And here, Bartolomeo de las Casas presented an argument which is the first in the world on natural rights, that there are rights possessed by the Indians which the kings had no right to abridge, and which they owned on other grounds than the conferral by the Spanish king. And these ideas had a powerful effect. It's not so easy to show that they had a direct effect on Locke, but they were in the atmosphere before Locke wrote. And Latin America is given no credit for this, the discovery of the idea of natural rights, or very little credit. Anyway, my subject tonight has to do more with the present situation and where we are to go. Boastful predictions of collapse of democratic capitalism are heard coming from Europe and even from some places in North America, usually by people who have always despised democratic capitalism anyway and just kept silent the last 30 years while it had its great successes. That's one fact to face. Second fact is that the rapid growth of militant tyrants seizing state power and squashing opposition is growing in every part of the world, Latin America not excepted. If we had a great period of the birth of democracies, we are seeing another period of the rebirth of tyrannies. And into the middle of this comes the great embarrassment of democratic capitalists, or even some people prefer to say liberal nations, in the horrible financial crisis in which we find ourselves embroiled. Let me set that subject aside for a moment and just say this. Whatever happens from the present financial crisis, what kind of systems do we want? What kind of systems, leaving all previous ideologies aside, would we like to see? There are three features that I think we long for, three freedoms that I think we would love to see and count any system a failure if it does not protect and produce. Namely, freedom from torture and tyranny, freedom from poverty, in fact, and finally, freedom to think and to speak, freedom of science and the arts and of religion, of conscience. Now, let me turn a page and remind ourselves, what did we ever mean by democratic capitalism in the beginning? We meant institutions whose aim was to lift poverty off the backs of the poor everywhere in the world. No economic idea, political economic idea, to this effect had ever been found until Adam Smith wrote The Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. And he meant nations. He had a vision, the first in history, of the development of all nations around the world, until the poverty that had been the habitual position of most people in history until then no longer persisted. There was never a theory of economic development before Adam Smith. That's a great achievement of his. And it was not just a personal vision, it was a social vision. It was not just a social vision, it was a global vision. And he therefore thought hard about the institutions which actually achieved this, the vision and the institutions. Second, we mean by democratic capitalism the political part. Institutions which protect us from torture and from tyranny, with checks and balances and protections of our rights. And also institutions which establish and protect the rule of law. You can't have a commercial society without the rule of law. The motto of Amsterdam for some centuries was Commercium et Pax, commerce and peace. But implicit in that was the rule of law. You can't have commerce unless there's a recognition of contracts made early and not fulfilled until much later. That's got to be there, or you cannot build for the future. And then I don't need to linger long on freedoms of the human spirit, to think, to believe, and to create, to invent, and to exchange an argument and idea, the spiritual freedoms, if you want. So political liberty, economic liberty, and moral and cultural liberty. I do think both what we hope for in the future, whatever system, has to meet at least those three tests. Set in the world, in some forms of practice, imperfect and some better than others, of that sort of institution and those sort of aims. What caused, the next point I want to address, what caused the current crisis in the United States? Because it illustrates these points. You know, I'm be terribly simple because I'm just a theologian, I'm not an economist. And we never did learn to count angels or anything else. There's first I want to emphasize, best expressed by my colleague Kevin Hassett in a recent article in Bloomberg, at whose publication he received more than 500 emails and more than one death threat. That at the bottom of our financial crisis, at least in the United States, is something that went wrong, sour, poisonous, toxic in the mortgage system. And the mortgage system is terribly important because it becomes the bedrock of most banks and financial institutions. If you own the mortgages, and nearly all people are repaying them, you have a constant stream of income from which you can make other loans. Well, in the 1990s, there arose a very powerful and I think good idea in the United States to try to make home owning as widespread as possible for as many people as possible, because homeowners act differently from renters. Homeowners give people a stake and teach a different set of virtues and so forth. I think that was a very good idea. But what went along with it was the idea that what we're going to have to do to provide this is to make some new laws. So the banks will no longer be free to demand down payments or to do financial investigations to be sure that the people to whom the mortgages are given have the ability to repay. Those two ideas are against all ideas of sound and safe banking in history. And very early on, particularly as the 1990s turned into the 2000s, there were people, writers, like Peter Wallison at our own American Enterprise Institute, and there were political leaders like George Bush, even in 2001, whatever you think of George Bush, and John McCain, who began to demand that there be much stricter regulation, that of the two greatest institutions of mortgage guaranteeing, partly government supported, government subsidized, Fannie Mae, as we call them, and Freddie Mac. And warning of the dangers that would result if their practices continued and home prices suddenly started to decline. Because the whole house of cards was built on the fact that however risky the mortgage is, the home prices will keep going up and will recoup. Well, it may be said that the Republicans for some years have been the party of deregulation. You can't say that exactly, because when deregulation was first born as an idea, Teddy Kennedy was one of the first to leap to its defense and practice in the trucking industry and the airline industry and so forth. The New York Times and the Washington Post both editorialized in favor of it. There had been a study made at AEI, forgive me for chauvinism here, was the first attempt to put a price on regulation. How much did regulation cost the country every year? It was a very primitive finding that they had, but it was meant to be at least something which could be refined year by year. Both the Washington Post and the New York Times said, wow, that's a great idea. How much does regulation cost? And we need to do a cost-benefit analysis of every regulation before we put it into effect. Anyway, it may be that the Republicans have been the party that sponsored deregulation, but in this case, in the mortgage market, they were the party that wanted regulation. They were the party that wanted a regulatory board, bipartisan, high quality, given ample powers, to make sure that the practices at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were curbed and given solid protections. What next happened, that was the failure of the political system. It wasn't done. Second, in the economic system, some very clever Wall Streeters, investors, got the idea, what we could do is package these mortgages, buy up a whole bunch of them. The strong ones mixed in with the others, put them in packages and sell them to investors. As I said, financial institutions want mortgages. That's the sort of foundation of their portfolios, because of the steady stream of income which they receive from them. And then these very clever people devised a second step of packages called derivatives. Now, I'm a theologian. I don't understand all that. But you know, it requires too much abstraction for me to cope with. I lose track of the concrete things. And of course, that's what happened with investors. They couldn't tell when they got these passages, let alone when they got these derivatives, which were the bad loans which were not going to be repaid and which were the good ones. It has only been about 5% of the home mortgages that have defaulted, gone into foreclosure. But 5% is a pretty powerful number on your investment, especially if you don't know where it is. In the package you bought, there might be a lot more than that. So that's why the trust in the financial system really was shut out from under. And I'm speaking very simply, I understand, but I try to do it in a way a theologian can understand, not in the way an economist could put it. So there was a real failure in the economic system to police itself and to contain itself, and there was too much money being made in all these clever transactions. And while housing prices were going up, it seemed like a great deal. And those of you who bought homes early in this cycle, I'm sure have benefited by such rising home prices that you couldn't think things were all bad. And that's the third fault of the system. Morally, I believe all of those of us who've benefited should have known that something this good smells. Something this good cannot be true. There is something wrong here. But we didn't. And we didn't require the investigations and the hard thinking that would have unmasked the difficulty. So our political system failed, our economic system failed, and our moral system failed. I mean, that's the heart of the system. Now, I want to go back and remind us in the next phase of this cycle of my remarks of some of the strengths that we look for and that were part of the foundation of democratic capitalism. I coined the name democratic capitalism. I wish I had a nickel for every time it's been used. But it wasn't used then, but I wanted to bring attention to the fact that our system is a political economy. It is not an economy alone. It depends on what government does and the rule of law and so forth. And I don't object to government doing some things to make the economy grow faster. For example, Lincoln with the Homestead Act. Well, I once tried to explain this in Mexico. It was the first talk I ever gave in Mexico on capitalism to a Catholic group worried about social justice and so forth. And some members here will remember very well how shocked people were to find a defense of capitalism. Afterwards, they took me to another room where the press had at me for 45 minutes or an hour, much too long. You never want to have that long a press conference, especially when you've only been in the country 3 hours. So they kept prodding me for my opinions of Mexico and so forth. And I kept saying, look, I've only been here 3 hours. I don't have any judgments to make. But at one point, I was describing Abraham Lincoln's Homestead Act, and I said his idea was he didn't want Iowa, my wife's home state, Missouri, and other states, to become slave states, plantations, for which serfs, or in this case slaves, worked, as in Europe and in the south of the United States. He wanted as many small owners as he could. And that gives more independence and more responsibility at the bottom. But in addition to that, increases the amount of intelligence operating on the economy. Each farming family, with its 40 acres or 70 acres, was able to decide for itself how to farm the fields that tilted toward the sun and those that didn't, those that had good moisture and those that didn't, those that did better in pasture and those that didn't. So they would make more realistic economic decisions with greater intelligence. There was more intelligence in 30,000 brains than if you took the 100 brightest people in the state of Iowa and let them make the decisions and the plans. And I said, it's like running with the brain that courses through every part of the body or with the pinhead brain of a dinosaur. And one of the journalists raised her hand and she said, you mean like Mexico? And I gave a pale yay, you know, like that. So the headlines the next morning were, North American theologian say Mexico has a pinhead brain of a dinosaur. You know, as I left the country, I thought there were going to be protests at the U.S. Embassy, there were going to be demonstrations. It turned out I became suddenly overnight popular in Mexico. That's what most people thought of the government, actually. But you see my point. Lincoln's, I don't mind that the government acted in opening up the American West. I don't mind that Lincoln insisted that every new territory must begin with a land-grant college. Every new territory must be built around a university. Why? Because he understood very well, he had a beautiful couple of lectures on this at Wisconsin and elsewhere, that the cause of wealth is ideas. The wealth is not in the land. The wealth is in the intelligence you bring to the land. And if you can figure out how to make the land yield 20 bushels instead of 2, you've given a great gift. It's Locke's idea, fundamentally. You've given a great blessing to the human race. And if you can figure out new ways to breed grass and hay and everything, I mean, oats and everything else. You're creating wealth. I think those are very good uses of government. It's not quite libertarianism. But on the other hand, the American idea is the government doesn't manage all this. The government helps and gets out of the way so that individual owners and individual operators can make the decisions. So ownership, I think, is very important. Second, I've already introduced the idea of invention. The real reason the system is called capitalism is because it refers to caput, the head, the capacity for invention and discovery. Adam Smith discusses this in the little passages about the pin factory, where he describes how long it took workers working alone to fashion a single pin, and how after the man invented the pin machine, which could impress hundreds of pins at a time, the situation in Britain went from a period in which only duchesses had pins to a situation in which every working woman in England had pins. And that wealth came from not because people worked harder, because there was an idea. There's all sorts of wealth hidden in the earth that God created, and God gave us the vocation to be co-creators with him and to discover this wealth and to unlock it and to take part in the completion of his creation. Third, and related to this, was the idea that at the local level, all this depends on the entrepreneur, on the person of enterprise. And enterprise is the forgotten virtue. Thank God for Hayek and for Israel Kirzner and a very few other writers who have uncovered this and stressed it. But it's a crucial virtue. The noun virtue occurs much more frequently, 30, 40 times more frequently in American English than in British English in the early 19th centuries. But why? Because when North Americans came here, and the same in Mendoza and Argentina and in 100 other places throughout Latin America, when they arrived, there was no Holiday Inn waiting for them. There were no churches from the 9th century already waiting for them. There were no glass factories or whatever waiting for them. Anything that was to be there, they had to invent for themselves. And of really great value to any village or any small community was someone who had the capacity to do this, who knew how to build a sawmill, or knew how to blow glass, or whatever, and could create a small industry in a village which gave employment and wealth which otherwise would not have been there. That's why in American schools, all across the country, if you go in the grammar schools, you'll see portraits of businessmen on the wall. These are the guys on whom the villages depend. And they're not looked down upon. They're the benefactors. You won't find that in Europe. They'll all be generals or dukes on the walls. Enterprise is a very important virtue, and it's a reality. I argue that in every country of the world, there should be an index, the most important index of economic growth, the number of new small businesses created every year. If you keep your eye on that, you know which countries are going up and which countries are going down. And a lot of that depends on public policy, setting the laws and the rules and the terms of incorporation and of the ability of, if you're poor and start a new business, you need an availability of credit because you got to pay people and build things before you get any profit from it. And it's important that, I remember when Poland became free after 1989, positing the question, what if after their liberty, and they said this is no longer a communist system, and they did away with the planning commission, and did away with the pricing commission, and allowed people to own their own land, and own their own businesses, and open their own bank accounts, what if everybody sat there and waited for the government to do something else? But in the first 6 months in Poland, 500,000 new small businesses were formed. And in the second 6 months, another 500,000. That was the birth of capitalism. Capitalism begins with the burst of ideas, and we have a wonderful English word, which I don't know if it translates or not, the stick-to-itiveness to stick to it until you make it work. There are a lot more bright ideas in the world than there are ideas that work. And enterprise depends on the second kind. Now, I want to point out that these characteristics, this growth from the bottom up of the sort I'm trying to describe, also have another character. They don't only create wealth, and they not only make possible a democratic republic, but they also introduce a change in the psyche. People who are owners have a different sense of the future and responsibility for the future, and are much more critical of politicians. Those who are creators have a much different eye for what's happening in politics to make creativity and invention and discovery more likely rather than less likely. And they are practical visionaries. They keep their ideas not on brilliant ideas, but on what will work, because they're investing their own funds. And so they produce people of a different moral quality. That's usually forgotten in my experience. I'm not that read in economic theories, but I think this moral effect of a capitalist and democratic system is usually overlooked, and it's the most powerful effect. And our founders were aware of it, at least in North America, and also Hume and David Hume, whose Histories of England bring this up, and from which Adam Smith and others learn. And finally, I want to end on the note of social justice. One of the skills brought about by a democratic capitalist system is the necessity of and the capacity to build associations. What is a business but an association? You try to, suppose you want to, let's take Bangladesh. Bangladesh, one of the poor countries of the world, has 3 or 4 harvests every year. It's rich with water and rich with sun. I remember being at the Rockefeller Foundation in the early 1970s, and we were publishing articles and booklets about starvation in India and a fortiori Bangladesh by 1984. It didn't happen. By 1984, India and Bangladesh were exporting food. And there were people in Bangladesh who were beginning to invest in how you preserve food. Not only grow and sell the fresh produce, but prepare juices and, I don't know the words for it, but vegetables in certain ways, so that you could become the breadbasket, not only of your own country, but of the world. One small item, in Bangladesh, after World War II, the population was 50 million. It's now 150 million. And you can say that's a tragedy, it's awful, it's a danger, it's a burden, but you have to put yourself in the position of a Bangladeshi family. It's darn nice when your children keep living after the age of 3. It's not that people in Bangladesh are having more children, they're having fewer. But the children live. And for their point of view, it's not a disaster, it's great. And anyway, you all know these points very well. I'm just reminding you what you already know. So my last point is, why is capitalism the best achiever of social justice? Hayek hated the word, but he practiced the reality. And let me explain. Hayek was one of the great practitioners of social justice in the world, though he hated the term. He hated it because most people who talk about social justice mean a status or a state of situation in the world which they find unequal or unfair or whatever else. And they mean by social justice some government program to correct it. You can understand why Hayek abhorred that, as all of us do. That's why we're here at the Philadelphia Society. But Leo XIII in the 1890s, 1891, was the first significant thinker in Europe to mention the term social justice. I'm going to prevent myself from talking about the whole history of it, but he had in mind that we live in a new situation in Europe, in which more and more people no longer live on farms. They're moving to the cities. They work for industries. And their connection with the family is very different. Their connection with their own wealth and well-being is very different. And they're being organized by socialists and communists. And he thought, this is dreadful for Europe, dreadful for the church, dreadful for Europe, and an instrument of tyranny. Inevitably would turn to tyranny. It's curious how negative he was about socialism when John Stuart Mill was writing so towards the end of his life as his wife got to him, so favorably and rosily about the future of a socialism. But anyway, Leo XIII described justice as a virtue. And this is where Hayek is something that inheres in a person. It's a capacity to do things that no other thing in the world has but a person. It's like learning to drive a car. Before you have the skill, it's awful. But once you master the skill, it's yours. Or even learning a language. It's very difficult. But once you learn a language, it's there, even if you don't get to use it for 2 or 3 years. When you go back, if you're immersed in it a little bit, it starts coming back. It's a skill that remains there. The person has been changed. Well, here's where I think capitalism, better than any other system, teaches the necessary virtues of social justice. And I want to explain why it's called social justice. Its vision, as I've mentioned, the vision of capitalism, is the elimination of poverty in all nations by creating new wealth, not by redistributing what's there. You know, Ray Kroc, when he invented McDonald's, put more teenagers to work than all the government programs for youth employment. And he paid taxes for the privilege. It didn't cost the government a cent. And he created a new good and a new service which had never been there before, from which we have all benefited. And he gave it with a genius that I think has been unremarked. He was looking to build a franchise that would offer cheap, quick, weight-free food that families would be attracted to and flock to and the children would enjoy. Not an easy combination. Why? Because more and more women were working. At least once or twice a week, a trip to McDonald's would be a treat for the family and for them. And then the brilliant thing he did is set his symbols in front of it, come to mama. I mean, it's so beautiful. If you're a literary critic, you can't miss it. And it worked. It worked tremendously. Again, this enormous wealth created with this idea, not costing the government purse, the public purse, anything. Secondly, the franchisees of McDonald's are all owners, or mostly owners, and they have the responsibility for how they design and train and the rest of it. And that, again, teaches a new kind of personality. It changes the persons who become managers or owners. It teaches them personal initiative, responsibility, and a capacity for action. You've got to act. You can't drift if things are not going right. It inspires and finances, capitalism does, social institutions independent of the state. There are a bunch of independent research organizations in this room. I just ask you, my own included, I just ask you for a moment to contemplate, where on earth does the money come from? It's come from businesses that produce in abundance and have wealth to share. And it gives us a source of wealth independent of the government. We don't have to turn to the government. When I go to Europe, I often find people would like to start a think tank or something else. There's no place to go. The habit of giving is not established. And the easiest way is to get some sway in the government to get a grant. I won't linger, but capitalism calls for and teaches many virtues. For example, to serve customers first. It's amazing to go to a well-run business and find if you make a complaint at the hotel about the bill, they take your side. And they'll look into it until you're proven wrong. I find that just astonishing. And I remember in Moscow when the first McDonald's was built there, and people flocked to it, lined up around the street for it, for one simple reason. It was the only place the Soviet republics where the workers smiled, where they greeted you with a smile, and where they had an interest in serving and they'd been taught that. That's a great virtue to teach. I still try when I go to Central Europe or Eastern Europe. I do my best to provoke guides and everybody else to smile once. It's sometimes very difficult. When you show up, you're just a drag on them. They could do just as well if you didn't show up as if you did. Treating others as equal, responsible agents. Learning satisfaction with modest but steady gains. Great Britain became the leading example of progress in human history in the 19th century by showing national growth of 1.5% a year, year after year after year, compounded. It was spectacular, but it wasn't zoom, zoom, zoom. It was just steady. And our founders thought that was the advantage of building a new republic on a commercial order rather than a military order or an aristocratic order. Commercial people were more realistic and more modest, more satisfied with less, and more interested in producing steady returns. Most of all, capitalism and democracy teach the skill of building associations. What's the Philadelphia Society? But an association formed by private citizens to meet a public need, who saw the importance of ideas in creating a public order, but saw the importance of finding an institutional way to bring people of ideas together, to benefit by the exchange, to draw comfort from one another's labors, to learn examples from one another. And democracy and capitalism have the facility to teach people the habits of association. And these habits of association are what Tocqueville called the first law of democracy. If people don't know how to form associations, they're just a mob. They're swept off their feet by passions. But if they have their own associations, they learn to act independently and to their own effect. They see results of their work. And they learn to love and take responsibility for what they're doing. Well, that's the key virtue of social justice. The virtue, the skill, the capacity to form associations, to lead them, to inspire them, and to make them work. And secondly, what makes social justice a virtue that is social is the aim of these associations is the public good. The aim of these associations are an order of liberty and equality and opportunity. That's what the Philadelphia Society was founded for. That's why it's a work of social justice. So I conclude by saying that the idea of democratic capitalism, we can lose it. You know, an idea has a lifespan of one generation. If a single generation turns out the lights and goes out, that's it. Freedom is extremely fragile. But those who want to keep rebuilding it, new generations have to learn from these associations and how to build associations and how to keep going an alternative to the state. Otherwise, the state just takes over inexorably. That's what states do. So I end up by commending you on the tremendous work you are doing, and whatever the outcome of the present crisis we're in, the present difficult times, I think we can be quite certain that having tasted them, the world and the future, at least enough people to make a difference, will aspire to have freedom from torture and from tyranny, and freedom from poverty, and freedom to think and to believe and to inquire, the liberties of the human spirit. And I commend the Philadelphia Society for keeping that vision alive since 1964. Thank you very much.